So we're off and running now on into the fourth foundation. I feel like we're in high school. No, actually, they build on each other, as I hope to show, and with each movement from each foundation, there's a degree of subtlety that we cross that requires a tuning of our hearing and listening. So when we enter this fourth, it's pretty subtle dharma. But first I want to read it, as I usually do when we start off a foundation, and remember that it doesn't always sound like I talk about it. What I often perceive, or how I perceive the suttas, is sort of like freeze-dried food. Doesn't really come alive until you add water, you know, and just, the suttas are so condensed. I mean, if you're going to tell somebody to remember something over 2,500 years, it better be condensed, and it better be exact, and it better be to the point, everything else left out, right? So if we want to bring the aliveness back in, we put it in some water, and sure enough, it starts multiplying. Also, the speech that is being used in this sutta, many of the commentaries say that it wasn't even written at the same, it wasn't even a continuous discourse. It was done over many years and pieced together from various discourses that the Buddha taught. So in over that number of years and that many piecings, who knows who the author really is, etc. But in any case, it has a rhythm and it has a pointing and it has a direction for us at this age that I think we can make some use of. So I'm gonna read it and then elucidate it a little bit. So the fourth foundation. There is the case where a monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the seven factors. And how does a monk remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five hindrances? There is the case where, there being sensual desire present within a monk, discerns that there is sensual desire present within me, or there being no sensual desire present within, he discerns how there is no sensual desire. And he discerns how there is the abandoning of sensual desire once it has arisen. And he discerns how there is no future arising of sensual desire that has been abandoned. This formula is then repeated for all the hindrances and the seven factors and the five aggregates. So I'm going to cut short that. In this way, he remains focused internally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or externally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or both internal and external on mental qualities in and of themselves. Or he remains focused on the phenomena of origination with regard to mental qualities, on the phenomena of passing away with regard to mental qualities, or on the phenomena of origination and passing away with regard to mental qualities. Or his mindfulness that there is mental qualities is maintained to the extent of knowledge and remembrance. Underline that. And he remains independently sustained by, not clinging to, anything in the world. This is how a monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves. Furthermore, the monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the Four Noble Truths. And how does he remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the Four Noble Truths? There is the case where he discerns, as it has come to be, that this is stress. He discerns, as it has come to be, that this is the origination of stress. He discerns, as it has come to be, that this is the cessation of stress. He discerns, as it has come to be, that this is the way leading to the cessation of stress. In this way, he remains focused internally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or externally, sustained by, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the seven factors of awakening, and it goes through all the different. Okay, so enough of that. I can put that aside. And So let's just start here. Let's just see what all that means. So I think the best way to understand what all that means is to move patiently tonight through the three previous foundations, because I don't want this to be bypassed. It's extraordinarily subtle. In fact, it's the removal. Up until this point, we've been investing our practice in the forms of the world, in the body, in breath, and physical sensation, in feelings, the arising of a tendency to be attracted to, or repulsed by, or neutral, and also into states of mind. What are states of mind? So now we're extracting our practice into awareness itself, into the formlessness. And because of that leap, the formlessness really doesn't have a way to be perceived. And so it talks in this sutta about what arises within the formlessness that determines whether what arising is detracting from or aiding and abiding within the formless. So there are states of mind that help us to abide more comfortably within the formless, and there are states of mind which obscure and detract us from that purpose and intention. But those states of mind become really where we focus our attention, or at least this sutta does, because to talk about the formless itself is, I mean, how do you talk about that? It's like talking about the air you breathe. So it gets very subtle, but I think we can flush it out a little bit as we start moving through this. The one word that is constant in many of those paragraphs, and which I think is at the heart of this foundation, is discernment. Discernment. Discernment is a quality of awareness itself, and discernment has a tremendous impact upon our meditation, upon our spiritual lives. It's misunderstood, but it really severs the last vestige, or can sever the last vestige, of the sense of self trying to remain in control of his or her life, because they are afraid that if they gave up their control, they wouldn't understand what would govern it. And this sutta, it's investing in the word discernment, which is now the governance of our life, rather than our sense of self-manipulation. So I'll get to that in just a minute, but let's start with the first foundation. First foundation, the Buddha is inviting us into the temple of our body. And really, it's the access point for understanding anything. We have to have an embodied relationship with ourselves. There's no question that many of us have had a history in which being in the body has not been a pleasant part of our experience, for whatever reasons. Physical or mental abuse is some of them, or just the fact that it doesn't look like what our cultural expectation of a body should look like. In any case, we have a very complicated relationship with the body. And anytime there's a complicated relationship, there's a lot of argument and brutality and conflict, and a lot of judgment that goes on. So when we come into the body, this is what we find. We find not serenity, for the most part, but at odds with itself, an edginess to our body. And so we're invited into the body, first to sustain our attention upon our breath, so that we have some stability and purpose to be able to ask the wise questions and be able to look and discern the answers from wherever this questioning takes us. Now, sustaining our attention on something is pretty much at the center of whatever meditation practice you would ever do. Staring at a mantra, or reciting a mandala, or staring at a mandala, or whatever, in its heart has a stabilizing the attention. So the attention is no longer moving with each thought as it comes in, but relatively stable, so they can see through the thought and perceive the actual experience of what the body is. Now we add an extra component to the meditation. It's not just sustaining our attention upon, but it's also noticing the awareness of what it is that we are looking at. That sense of awareness begins to be invited into our consciousness in our spiritual practice through that first invitation of mindfulness in the body. Mindfulness of the body is not just being in the body, it's being aware of the body, so that the body can, we can feel the aliveness within the body, so that the body isn't this dead thing that we just sort of drag around, but it's alive. And as soon as we bring our attention into the body, it alivens. It really does feel very different when we have learned how to reside in our body than when we sort of stay a few thoughts away from it. And this sense of body has both a personal and an impersonal implication for us. It's personal because it's mine. And although we may not actually think of ourselves as being a body as much as we think of ourselves as being the mind, we think we have a body rather than us being the body. And yet the body feels very much a part of the opening door of this meditation. And we realize that unless we come in and abide within this body, we're not going to be able to see anything, because we have to settle with this body first as a first step to being able to have any kind of composure to be able to see anything else. So our history, of course, comes out whenever we allow consciousness in. What is in there comes out to show us itself. And so, sure enough, probably much of what we feared, certainly our grief and our fear and our psychological scars, are very much attuned to the body. And yet there's this awareness that as we start nurturing it, as we start focusing, as we start bringing it forward, makes it okay somehow, or begins to. Not in the beginning. In the beginning it's terrible and I want to leave, and what's good is meditation, right? But after a while, we see a potentiality here, a possibility, where awareness is taking the edge, the critical judgmental edge, off of what we see. We learn ways to align ourselves with what we see that are not so contentious. And after some time and some practice, lo and behold, we learn how to embody ourselves. We learn how to embody ourselves, and we learn along the way that awareness has a healing component too. And so whenever we feel something difficult arising, our old tendencies were to turn away from it. Our new tendency is to invite it and to look at it, to see it, because we have this growing confidence that the seeing of it itself stabilizes our relationship to it and makes it okay. Makes it okay. So there's this beautiful tool that seems to be cultivated within this first foundation that is extraordinary, really. And of course, there's the over personalization of the body is not so helpful. So in this sutta, especially in the monastic tradition, they send us off to charnel grounds and places like that so we can get a sense that it's just meat. Take away the temptation and the lust that we have within it. And we carve it up to 32 parts, and we look at feel the spleen, and we feel the ankle, and we feel the tongue, and all the different ways that we like that. And that's a meditation in and of itself. Each one to sort of give us a sense that yes, this body is a very important temple, but if you hold on to it, if you lean into it, if you get attached, or if you grasp a hold, then it's going to rub and hurt and cause a lot of suffering. So we better square ourselves in harmony with this body, even though we take it to be an important aid to our practice. Now, the body is also a representation of all objects. It's just a very personal object. But it's also a representation of how we relate to the external world. This is very important for where we're going tonight, because we infuse so much worth in the external world that we find much of our lives an attempt to chase after that and to somehow gain some access or closeness to that so that I can be comfortable with the things of my wishes, my wants and desires around me, and then I can have a comfortable life because I have comfortable things around me, including money or whatever objects I so wish. And so it's an investment of what? It's an investment of our awareness, of our attention, of our life energy, let us say, into the objects external from me. Now, this is very important, because once we begin to bring our attention into the body, which is a very close object, it's tied to us in some ways, we also begin to learn that the overinvestment of energy into this body creates the very rub that we are trying to heal ourselves from. It creates the tension, it creates the overbearingness, the sense of control. The clutching, the grasping, and we begin to realize, because we have now an internal response to an object rather than an external response to an object, we don't quite feel it in the same way. I love these flowers. If you're aware, you can see the clutching, but when you have the body around all day long, you see a clutching very up front and personally, don't you? So you say, wait a minute now. See, somehow I have to start releasing the energetic need for this to be a certain way, and the annoyance of it when it's not, and all the expectations that go with it, and all of that. All right. So first foundation is huge. It just gets us in the door, but unless it settles us and it allows us to have a certain orientation to life, to ourselves, it begins to do access awareness and the healing component of awareness. It begins to divest our over leaning into things of life. You see, huge. Very. So now the Buddha takes us. One other thing about the body that I meant for this sutta, and that is that there's a phrase in there that I like very much. It's not in all the sutta's interpretations, but it's in this one, and it says, which is one of the reasons I use this, it says, as you release yourself from the knowledge and remembrance. Now that's key, because as we come into the body, everything is so personal, isn't it? It's like, God, that scar, and that's where I had my appendix out, and that's where I hurt my shoulder, and my back's never been okay, my neck hurts, and how's my body look? Am I sitting okay? Do people like me? It's all that. It's all of that. That's over-personalization of an object, right? So as we are willing to sit with this thing, and we begin to see what our mind does to personalize something, that it just constantly invests again and again in the history of what that thing is, and we just keep running along, writing new chapters to that history. And so there's always this kind of journaling, internal journaling that's going on in relationship to what is I'm seeing and how I'm doing, how my meditation is, and all that sort of busyness. But when the Buddha takes that away from us and says, now enter it without knowledge and remembrance, what is the body now? Without it being in lockstep to the memory of what it was a moment ago, what is it in its when I actually touch the fabric of the experience of it? Does it even look like a body? Does it feel like a body? Is it contained like a body? Is it mine? Or is that a mental addition to what it is that's being perceived? So there's this moment where we realize that we're bringing ourselves along with everything, that the realization can occur, and hopefully it will occur at some point, that the only reason this thing is held with an I, me, or mine is because we've rehearsed it, and we continue to invest that rehearsal in every act and performance of the body itself. So that's very, these are all extraordinarily important components of understanding the body. And I could go on and on, because there's also a groundedness that comes when we're in the body, a confidence, an established certainty that we are part of the earth. In fact, the body is our little container of earth that we're carrying with us. And this sense that we can be nowhere else. I mean, as long when the mind is works as hard as it works, we could be anywhere else. I wish I were somewhere else. But when it starts, which is the reason the M.S. Merwin poem, at some point you think, my God, this awareness, I couldn't be anywhere else. And then everything comes alive around that certainty of our own position. You see, I couldn't be anywhere else. There's no place I could possibly be. Everything else is just an imaginative response to being here. And then everything opens up and awakens from that. So first foundation is a temple gate. But the Buddha doesn't stop there. He gets more subtle. He says, okay, come in through the temple. Now we're going to look about on how things are formed, how we form ourselves, how we form dualistic notions of you and me, how we form a world in which we have an inviting story about everything and everyone, how our memory leads the way in terms of what we see and our expectations of what will happen. And so now we're inviting the second foundation from the first. We don't throw the first out, so now let's get on to the second. From the body, we start feeling feelings. Feelings, for those of you who are just new in attendance, are not emotions, not in this case. That comes in the next foundation. Right now, they're just leanings. They're like a propensity to lean towards something pleasant, a propensity to for any experience, conditioned tendency to be unpleasant, and thereby we lean backward, away from it, or something that's neither pleasant or unpleasant. We don't really care about it, and therefore we don't have an obvious feeling of attraction or avoidance for it, and we just bypass it. We don't even think about it. We don't even notice it. So we start looking at the very formation of the sense of self. Now, we didn't get to that degree of subtlety in the body. The body was mine. I was still here. We began to look at some of the basic strategies by which the body forms itself into I through remembrance and that, but we haven't gotten really to the nitty-gritty here. Okay, so now we are actually seeing the formation of self in the body. Well, you can see, not just from the body, but in any experience of life, how there's a leaning towards or a leaning away, based upon the feeling we have of that conditioned object. Remembering this, that the feeling is conditioned in me. I'm the one that has the feeling. The object doesn't have the feeling. I have the feeling for the object. Now I'm leaning according to what my mind tells me. It has nothing to do with that object, you see. All objects are neutral from that sense. But we're like this all the time, rocking horses, towards or away. And what happens as soon as we start leaning is that there's an immediate shifting towards noise in the mind. You lean towards, you're at rest, an object comes into view which you like, which is pleasant, and then what you're trying to do in leaning towards it is you're trying to milk it. You're trying to grasp it, you're trying to bring it closer, you're trying to maintain it, you're trying to increase its duration of time with you. That's what the leaning is. If you feel it, if there's a tightness, there's a clutching that's going on there. As the mind gets tight, it's no longer loose now. And that tightness, the corresponding narrative that goes along with that tightness is, I've got to have this, this is really important to me. Is anybody looking? I'll take it if it's extreme. But there's this sense of an embodied speech internal for that particular, and it fits in. It fits in to my past desires, to my past longings, to all the things that are important to me in life, all the things I've ever wanted. And those change, of course. Some pleasant things become unpleasant after a while, reconditioned. But nevertheless, this leaning stays pretty consistent, and the narrative is a linear narrative. It just keeps going. It just keeps writing new chapters. Now, if we look, if we're willing to look at that point where we start talking about something, you'll see you're very much in the picture. Jim, Jack, Joe, Sharon, Linda, you're all in the picture now. Until that, there's just quiet, just serenity. Something crosses the eye or any of the sense doors, a leaning occurs, the embellishment in terms of what that is to me, what it means to me, and then the papancha, the forever elusification of what and how I want that. But the sense of self now is story run. It's built upon the story. It keeps adding to the story. It does not want to be quiet now. Quiet is not where it looks. It likes the sense of pursuit. It likes the sense of grasping. It likes the sense of moving out to gain things. It feels accomplished when it does gain things. It feels accomplished when it successfully avoids what it doesn't want. That sense of accomplishment builds self-esteem in us. We think we're good people. We think we're doing what we need to do. We think we're productive and useful people. And so the story isn't about to go to zero. And so if we're not leading, we'll storytell anyway. What we'll storytell ourselves about is just complete fantasy. We won't have, until something crosses our path again that pulls us back in and often we're running. Also, this thing about the story that's very important is that the sense of accomplishment, the sense of getting self-betterment, self-fulfillment, is always in time. So the story has generated its own relationship to time. Past, when I didn't have it, present, when I'm feeling the need for it, and the future, when I can obtain it. And so this sense of time and being compelled by time is also a part of the unfolding of attachment to feelings. This is huge, right? This is what is to be discovered within this foundation of feeling. Not a small thing. I'm on the second foundation and I have 20 minutes. I have not started the fourth. So the third foundation. Okay. I don't want to go fast. I want to pace. So the third foundation. All right, now we've seen how the sense of self is formed. The third foundation, in just a brilliant, is that it looks at the mind itself. No longer just an aspect of mind, the feelings. It looks at all states of mind. And, brilliantly, it does nothing about any of it. It says, look at this and see when this is present, see when it's not present. See when this is present, see when you're desiring, see when you're not desiring. See when you're angry, see when you're not angry. It doesn't say always be. See when you're concentrated, listen to this one. See when you're not concentrated. Don't always be. Doesn't say always be. As soon as there's an always be, there's a feeling towards it, a narrative with it, and you are chasing it. You see? You got to bring the second into the third so that the wisdom factor awakens. Oh, I see what he's doing. He's taking me out of the picture now. He showed me how I was formed in the second foundation. Now he's taking me out of the picture in the third foundation. Because if I'm not doing anything, I'm useless. I don't have any sense of future. It's just this. It's just this. See it? Just this. See when it's there, see when it's not there. Now it's not there. You know? So I'm not asked to do anything with it. This is brilliant in its simplicity because it invites a kind of spaciousness, emptiness, so to speak. Right? And so it's like, wow, you know, this is really taking me out of the picture. And if we are aligned with the true urgency towards liberation, This is magic time. Because you've seen how you've come in to being, and you can also now see how you can release the dualism of that coming into being. Just coming into being on that second foundation doesn't necessarily allow us to end it. But now doing nothing, the simplest thing in meditation, spiritual journey is the simplest thing. If it's complicated, you are off running it mentally. The simplest thing is, well, doing nothing, just abiding with, just being present too. So the sense of self doesn't have any way to build upon itself when it's not doing something to the object. And the now listen to this, because this is important. The investment, the energetic investment we were giving in the doing and the story creating and the elaboration of history and future, where does that go? In the conservation of energy, third law of the of some dynamic, thermodynamics, where does that energy go? In any closed system, the energy is conserved. All right, so it has to go somewhere. It goes to awareness. So in the non-doing, the awareness, the energy goes out. It goes to the space. It goes to the formless. You see, since up until this time, we've been so interested in the forms of life, we haven't even understood what the formlessness is. It sounds like some kind of Zen thing. But you see it, you experience it now. Now, how do you experience awareness? Because I said before that it was through the sense doors, it's impossible. There's a visceral sense of it you can get. You can get a visceral sense of awareness. Be quiet in yourself now and just feel it. Just allow it to arise. Whoa, now you see, it's not like you can see it. And you hear it or smell it or taste it, there's a kind of acknowledgement of it that's profound enough that there's not, it's unquestioned. It's unquestionable. You can't, it's not arguable. And so now, okay, so now we're starting to move into a formlessness. And we begin to see, oh, emptiness, I'll call formlessness. Also emptiness. Emptiness is not empty. I say this because I don't want the word to scare you. It's full. It's vital. It's intelligent. Not your intelligence. All right? Not your intelligence. But the awareness itself holds an intelligence. A poor metaphor for awareness is like a light shining. It's, well, the reason that that's a metaphor at all is that a light reveals what it's shining upon. So does awareness. But light is not alive. It's not, and awareness is. It's the heart of aliveness. So as we begin to feel this other component of life, we begin to understand that we have just been investing in the wrong aspect. We've been investing in the forms. The forms are dead, but we've wanted the forms, so our aliveness has gone towards the wanting, desire, and not towards life itself. And now, since we have seen how wanting is forming me and the story and my antagonism and my eventual suffering, well, I just take a more sobering view of life than to want everything that passes in front of my sight. And so there's more and more available energy, awareness. Whoa, this is getting amazing now. Awareness itself. A friend of mine, another teacher friend, uses a beautiful analogy, which takes us into the next foundation. Let me just finish up with the third foundation. So we begin to see that the forms that are still coming up, the states of mind that are still arising, it's not so important what the state of mind is, because the Buddha says, don't do anything about them. How serious can I take them? If I can't do anything about them, he sort of says, that's it. You got to deal with it. You don't do anything to it. So all of a sudden, what's perceived when something arises, a state of mind, is what holds that state, what is being held within. I missed it when I was trying to do something about it, because I was in such a tension relationship with it that I wasn't interested in what was holding. I was interested in getting rid of it. But now that's been taken away from me in this third foundation. Now I have to simply be present. And then I see that it is not alone and never was, because all things are held within awareness. And awareness, up until this point, we had thought it was an internal response. It was what I was doing back when I was being mindful of the body. I was bringing my awareness to the knee pain and to my breath and to this and that. It was all under my control. I had no idea or no sense that it was something that pre-existed outside of me, that it was the very, it was what imbued life to be a life, all of life. And suddenly, this thing changes and it gets a feeling that life, it's not just about me and my struggles. I mean, I have to take that seriously, but there's something grander here, something enormous at stake. And so, what holds this form? Seeing and awareness. Now, mindfulness, although from time to time I'll still use it on my breath or something that is difficult, I'll intentionally focus, now evolves towards awareness, towards that which holds life. And the tension is off trying to make mindfulness work. That's another step back. You're decreasing your suffering. And you think, oh, if I'm not in control of my mindfulness, it'll just leave me. No, it doesn't. In fact, with your intention being well honed by this foundation, if you're moving into this foundation, your intention now is governing your spiritual journey, and your intention will not let you forget that consciousness is where we're moving here. And so, releasing tension allows more things to be conscious. It was the tension that kept things from being conscious. And so even mindfulness, releasing the need to have to be mindful, actually creates more awareness. It's very interesting. It seems paradoxical, but in fact, that's how it works. It waits for your lessening of tension, for you to retract your tension with life. And what happens when that occurs is that it wakes up. It shows you that what you held in such clamped down control actually has a life of its own, and you can now partake and connect with that life. So it's a beautiful, see, all of this, each one of these steps has a profound shift within one's spiritual journey. You see? Now, is that, when I read it, you hear that? I don't. You have to infuse some life into this thing, people. If you hold yourself to leather or word, it's like eating freeze-dried food. Don't do that. Not if you live with anybody. And those of you who know what I'm talking about there, the gas that's produced. So now we have 5 minutes left, and we're going to go. Now, so we're just starting this. We're just starting this foundation. We're just welcoming ourselves into this foundation, you see. So I'll give this talk in a couple of weeks. No, so this foundation. Okay, now... what we're lighting upon, now we're getting a sense of awareness itself. And the one aspect of awareness that we can readily connect with is discernment. We've always claimed ownership of that discernment, because mostly we opinionate We don't really discern, we opinionate. So first we have to look at the difference between opinionation and discernment. Opinionation always have an accompanying judgment and story. It has, oh my God, he's coming down the street, how do I avoid him? On and on. Discernment does not have an accompanying narrative. It's quiet. But it sees and it knows. This is another whole level up. Because each time a foundation is moved towards, the vestiges of what was not cleaned up in the previous foundation now has a possibility of being cleaned up. What can be cleaned up on this one? Something that for most of us has been a burden. The fear of being out of control. The fear of needing self-protection. There hasn't been any other way to sort of get an inroad into that one, except this foundation now gives it to us through discernment. Because what we begin to see is all the things that we counted on for our memory, our opinions, our judgments, all the way that we've infused life with the certainty that we know of it, can now be discerned immediately rather than continued in terms of a narrative. What arises now is faith, where not faith in me, which is where faith was invested prior, but faith in life showing itself, in the ability of life to reveal itself. And it's amazing how subtle that discernment can be. You know when you're being manipulated, you know when somebody, you almost feel the intent of what somebody is coming to you with. There's a level of extraction from life that is beyond most of us when we are noisy. But in that quietude, there's a sensing, a creative sensing, not just, it's a creative sensing that knows a wise response, it has a beautiful relationship with life, and there is this, how to say this without sounding a little corny, and that is that my teacher always used to tell me, well, the Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma. And I said, oh, that sounds really good. I'll put it on my wall and forget about it. But there is a way in which life comes in to hold you in, to hold you, what's the word I'm looking for? Some adjective that is kindly or gently, that wasn't there when we were good in our own governance. It's this beautiful access to all of life through stillness, through quiet, and the sense of protection, but not, I mean, not that a brick won't fall on my head, it certainly could, but just somehow that, I don't know, there's just some aspect of knowing about life that wasn't there, and which I, when it wasn't there, I needed to protect myself. Now, in each of these, there are little sayings that help us get in line with it. Okay. In the third foundation, when there was any kind of doing with the states of mind, we could say, is there love for this too? And that would take the doing out of it, wouldn't it? So just, okay, is there love for this too? And the third foundation would take the doing out. If you're doing something about it, you're not loving it. You're manipulating it. You're trying to get it so that it fits your idea. That's not love. Sitting around and complaining to somebody about how they're not fit, they don't fit what your expectations of them are and how dearly you love them if they would just, that's not love. Love is leaving something alone. Now, let me ask you, just from that, how many of you have a loving relationship with your parents? You see? Okay, so I rest my case. Not many of us, that's an expression that we can keep inviting forward. We can keep inviting forward. to allow the non-doing. None of the, we're never finished with any of these foundations, but we can keep walking them. Okay, now there are a couple of really good ones that are for the fourth foundation. Because, you see, I mean, as I read the sutta, it says, you know, discern whether the hindrances are arising, discern when the hindrances aren't. The hindrances aren't what's important. The sense of discernment is what's important, that you know what's there. You know, oh, what's there? This isn't going to be so helpful. If you're angry in consciousness, that's not a very helpful state of mind for the resolution of suffering. So you don't feed it. You don't do something to it. You just don't do anything to it that you usually do to it with it to keep it going. So you extract your need to keep it going by just being quiet with it. Now that's real not doing, right? Now then it will fade on its own. Now this is important. What happens when something fades on its own? What happens to anger or any state of mind when we're not investing our narrative in that state of mind? Oh, there's anger again. I've lived with anger. I'm such an angry person. Well, no wonder my father was angry. When we're not investing that in the state of mind, what happens? When we're not doing something to it, what happens? That energy gets it's no longer invested in that. It gets divested in that. In the very state of mind in which we were so antagonistic to, we were so angry with, can't sustain itself. And what's it turn into? It turns into the single essence of all things, which is awareness. Now that's the mystery of this thing. That's the magical mystery tour. Just gone completely around. That we are creating something from nothing, from our need to be something, to do something to the something we created. And when we see, when we reverse that process through the third foundation and now into the fourth, we realize that whatever arises within consciousness, within awareness, it's like when the Buddha said, "Oh, Mara, I see you." Oh, okay, I can go towards this thing and make it louder, increase the drama of it, and then lose myself and lose my whole referencing. Or I could just notice the effect it has, feel the leaning, but don't add anything to it, don't do anything with it. Because you, along with it, you don't stay there as the masterful meditator who just made anger empty. You become empty along with it. Those two arise together. If you're not doing something to it, it can't sustain its somethingness, and neither can you. Because what was required of you to sustain your somethingness was the narrative you were investing in that something to sustain it. You following this? Now, what are you going to do? Isn't this beautiful? I just think this is so beautiful. I hope we have much more to go into in this. And we're going to look at how discernment, see, there's a passive discernment and an active discernment. Passive discernment is what I've been just talking about. It's just being present. It's a beautiful stillness, beautiful. But there's an active discernment. And you say, well, how can awareness be active? You are a composition of awareness, and you don't seem to be sitting still and doing nothing. You're manifesting all the activity of life. So too, awareness gets active. It gets questioning. It gets investigative. It gets curious. It moves, looks, it sees. And so much of what we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks is going to be to flush out that particular aspect of the fourth foundation. Okay, good. Isn't this fun? I don't know if you're having fun. I'm having fun. Okay, let's just sit for a minute or two. So now, you see, we've gone a lot. This is a lecture that went very far. Doesn't matter where you are or whether you got lost, and doesn't matter. Just go where you're naturally working, and be interested in learning from where you're working, so that you won't stay there for the rest of your life. You know, you can get as caught in the workings of yourself meditatively as you can of the workshops of working yourself externally in terms of self-betterment. It's just, you can just get into this kind of rhythm of always having to do something about yourself, because we're never settled with ourselves. We don't believe that we're basically okay. We work that, oh, he doesn't know me, he would never say that. No, I know you likely better than you know yourself. And so I can say that. And I can say that about everyone, not just you, because it's universally true. Okay, so let us have any questions or comments. I'd be happy to entertain them. Yes, sir. Well, we've been using discernment actually all along the way. We've just been claiming ownership of discernment all along the way. When we first started out and started seeing our breath, we were discerning the breath. The awareness was seeing it, so there was discernment in there. But we kept weighing in with our opinions, which were so thick that we lost. We saw what we saw, but we thought, first of all, we were doing the seeing, so it was our mindfulness. And secondly, our opinions were so loud within what we were seeing that it was sometimes very difficult to know whether we were discerning it or opinionating. You know, my breath again, God, why is it all of that heaviness that we bring to our meditation. Now as we go up and march up these foundations, we start doing less and less. Our long since, in the third foundation, we passed through judgment. Judgment pretty much got screened out in the body, the first foundation, because the body is, if there's an object in which all of us have some judgment about, quite likely it's the body. And so we carry this sense of judgment around with us, and when we invite attention into it, it's so hellish in there with all the judgment that's going on and all of the coarseness of that and the friction, sparks are flying. We've got to figure this out. And so what happens is that we figure out that the judgment is because there are basic assumptions about ourselves that haven't clearly been understood. And that once those assumptions, those basic tenets of who we are seen, then maybe the judgments, which are the symptoms of those issues, will fall away. And so what we begin to do is that when we find we have a judgment, we feel the pain from where that judgment is coming from. We see that the pain has some way that I'm holding my psyche in that moment, about body or mind or personhood, some expectation, and we start deciphering the codes of our own suffering by turning towards the unpleasant, which greatly diminishes the amount of judgment we have, all within that first foundation. So we've taken it seriously. And so when we come to the third foundation, there might be subtle judgments that are still arising as states of mind come in. And oftentimes there's still a sense of a seer seeing it, a watcher watching it. But the judgment is very light. It's not heavy, and it's not reactive, and it's not doesn't send us skidding across the room like it did early on. And so this quieting of judgment, this quieting of interactive narrative with whatever it is that we see, slowly, as we divest in trying to change it, what gets invested is that which holds it. And as that gets invested in that which holds it, it gets quieter, not noisier. And then we are moving in a wise direction. So it's all along the way. We just do this all along the way. We're working this thing towards freedom, towards looking at where we are being held, contracted, restrained, constrained, all along the way. Working it, see, that's all discernment. So the discernment, when the judgment gets less, the discernment gets more, because the discernment was always there, it was just being held or influenced by the judgment. So as the judgment gets left, the discernment, the seeing, just this. Just this. Yes. The question was, when you love something, did I make a statement that when you love something, you leave it alone? I mean, of course, yes, ultimately, you're not weighing in trying to get it to fit your particular interpretation. But that doesn't mean that there isn't skillful action that you take on its account. So that if a child is in the middle of a road, you don't just leave it alone. You know, you go pick it. I mean, it's obvious, but... So love also has an active component too. But what I mean by leaving alone is that there's not this forced pressure to try to alter the person to your particular ideal of him or her. You leave that alone. That's left alone. You let them grow as they grow. Right? And everyone feels it when somebody, you feel it as love. To this day, I remember my grandfather holding me on my knee at probably age 3 or something. And I remember the feeling of being loved unlike anyone else that had ever held me. He was this old guy who's a YMCA director. And he must have loved children or he wouldn't have been in the work. And he just the way he held me, I thought I could stay here. I didn't think this, but the feeling was I could stay here forever. You know, it's like, don't let me down. I don't want to get down from this. I think that's the acclaim. I think that's the meeting of love. I think that's what the feeling or the resonance is when we feel love. Okay, we've got to go on to announcements. Thank you all. We'll have a discussion on this particular topic next Tuesday. So please do attend.